This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Well, this is an exciting day. I don't have just one author with me. I have three authors, but the beautiful thing is she's all rolled into one. So I have Amanda Elliott, Juliet Gray, and her real name is Leslie Carroll. Hi, Leslie.
Hi, Patsy with a Z. It's Leslie with an S. Yeah, hi.
Oh, it's so good to talk to you again. I think of you all the time because whenever I see, you know, the royal family, and they're getting a lot of coverage, I think of you and I think of what a wonderful time you must have had when you were asked to write a book about, you know, Meghan Markle and the American Princess came out.
I have to say this was my idea. I knew that this was going to happen, and I knew that this was the biggest thing to ever happen to Britain's royal family in the 1,000 years of British, you know, British royal history. Here you are breaking all of the rules. It used to be that an actress was barely acceptable as a royal mistress. We know what happened when Edward VIII wanted to marry an American divorcee in Wallis Simpson, although that has, you know, its Nazi origins and all of that stuff, and Meghan Markle was not that. But you have an American marrying a crown prince. You have and a divorcee and somebody that attended a Catholic school, even though she herself is not Catholic, but, you know, that in itself, there was a law passed that anybody who had married a Catholic couldn't be on the throne, and an actress, and excuse me, everything, all of these former no-nos, and then you add, well, the race card, a woman who has an African-American mother and a white father, and you are bringing in all of that history into British colonialism, and wow, you are changing the face of the royal family. And I thought, this is going to be news. The very fact that they are dating is news, and so I knew that this was going to be the biggest story to ever hit the British royal family. And the only tough sell was finding a publisher that could turn around a story, because, you know, British royals do not have long engagement periods. They kind of announce it, and then they can put together a spectacle like nobody's business and throw together a royal wedding in half a year, while as it takes the average American a good year to throw a wedding at, you know, Leonard's of Great Neck. So there I was with my agent going, yeah, this is a great story. Now we just need to find a publisher who has a big enough machine to turn this around. And thank God for my a former editor at HarperCollins that said, oh, heck yeah.
Oh, yeah. You can't miss that opportunity.
And I knew what title I wanted. I knew it had to be American Princess, though she's a duchess. So,
well,
but, you know,
in our hearts, she's a princess.
In our hearts, she's a princess. And what's interesting is, for those of us who were following the British premiere of The Lion King and how exciting it was for Beyonce to meet Meghan and Meghan to meet Beyonce, who were lip reading, were watching Meghan and Beyonce hug each other, and Beyonce said to Meghan, "My princess."
Oh, and you did such a great job with the book. Because you, not only did you bring out their love story, you also brought in the history, so much of British history, and so much about Princess Di. And
it had to be in context.
Yeah.
The phrase, you know, men marrying their mothers. And I had always said that if men marry their mothers, for Harry, this was in the bag, because Megan was always a philanthropist, and she was always huggy and warm and touchy-feely, just like Harry. Harry has said in an interview, you know, "I'm told I give good hugs." And it's sweet. You see him with kids and how warm he is, and he was always the warmest and huggiest and most accessible member of the royal family, the young royals. And Meghan is very much the same way. And both of them on their first date, they talked for hours, and it wasn't just the physical attraction. It was, they said they both sort of wanted to save the planet, and that's what got the second date in the bag, was they were talking about all the good they could do in the world and all the projects they wanted to take on.
Well, I think the book was so exciting to read it at the time, and of course it's one of these books that's going to be a forever book, because people will go back to it, you know, many years from now, and because it is part of history. And for you, that you then got to go to England and see the wedding in real time.
It was so much fun. It was so much fun. And I just want to go back a little bit to the book and how I structured American Princess, because the subtitle is the love story of Meghan Markle and Prince Harry. And it was very important to me, because we look at it and see how improbable it would be. If you were to say, "I'm going to write a book about how an African-American actress who is the descendant of slaves marries the grandson of the Queen of England," you would say, "Oh, that sounds like a really silly Hallmark movie or a Harlequin romance, and I'm going to throw it against the wall and laugh at it." But it's real, and it happened. But I wanted to tell the story and kind of alternate chapters and juxtapose it from their childhoods to their teenage years to finding their footing in their various professions and how they kind of stumbled along the way and then came into their own, and then how they met each other and their courtship, which the British press loves to describe as a whirlwind, but it was 17 months. My husband and I actually had a shorter courtship than that, and we have the same wedding day of May 19th, so that's, I just felt kind of warm and fuzzy about that.
But it was like it was meant to be.
I know, it was so exciting. They picked such a great day. I was like, oh, so happy for them. And I put that in the book, too, at the very end, that said, you know, thanking my husband for being so patient while I had such a short time to write the book, saying that Meghan and Harry were going to be married on a May 19th, which was our anniversary, and I hope that they would be as happy as we were over the dozen years or so of our marriage. But Meghan and Harry, really, 17 months is not really a whirlwind in the grand scheme of things when you consider actually how quickly British royals tend to get engaged and then turn around their actual wedding day. But I wanted to show, Patsy, how seemingly incongruous and almost, you know, as we absurd on the face it would be, and for somebody of Meghan's background in the past, and that's why I wanted to, as you say, set the historical context of how improbable or impossible it would have been for someone of Meghan's background to have married into the royal family, or even how impossible it would have been for her to be a royal mistress. There are now articles coming out where Queen Elizabeth's husband, Prince Philip, had, it is rumored, told Harry, you know, "One steps out with actresses, one doesn't marry them." So that's the view of the mid-20th century. So even as recently as, the 1930s through 80s, "One steps out with actresses, one doesn't marry one." You know, and here's Harry marrying an actress, not only an actress, but an actress who was a person of color. But yet in the book, I show how Harry and Meghan have a whole lot more in common with each other than these surface differences. That they both went to private progressive schools, that they both have had mothers, both Diana, Princess of Wales, and Doria Ragland, who is Meghan's mother, were women who were warm and fuzzy and huggy, and very hands-on mothers who brought their kids literally brought their kids to soup kitchens and homeless shelters and told them that just because you have more than other people, it doesn't make other people less than you are. And really instilled their children with values and morals and social consciences. So no wonder these two ended up together, because they really are two peas in a pod in terms of, you know, wanting social justice and wanting to help the world and wanting to save the children. So they were a perfect match for each other.
And now they have the baby. I love the name Archie.
Archie Harrison. And I grew up in Riverdale in the Bronx. So I thought, oh, Archie, that's hysterical. You know, the Archie comics and everything, you know.
Yeah, but I got a kick out of it.
They just like the name.
I got a kick out of it. I like the name Archie. I thought, yeah, I like that. I can see that.
It's kind of cute, and it's not Archibald. He's just Archie.
Yeah.
He's little Archie.
I think
Harrison, of course, is Old English for Harry's son, so that was kind of right on the money.
Oh, it is. Well, I think it's a beautiful story, and you did it so much justice. Just give us a little behind the scenes what you did when you were there. Where were you standing? What, you know, just a little bit of that.
I was in Windsor. I went to London about 4 or 5 days before the wedding, and I was doing international interviews. I hit the ground running. I was staying in a hotel in central London, and I did an interview with Australia, and a couple of interviews with Australia and New Zealand press. So I was doing Commonwealth press interviews from London. And I was actually supposed to have an interview a few hours before the morning of the wedding with CNN. And then there was a terrible mass shooting in Texas. And CNN took its crew and was apparently devoting, it was hard to tell from Great Britain what was going on in the States, because at that point the time difference and kind of being completely immersed in royal wedding 24/7 because of my profession at the time, CNN grabbed its crew because I was supposed to be on CNN nightly. CNN, you know, has a zillion different shows. And the CNN show I was supposed to be on, which was literally supposed to be something like 3 in the morning British time, they needed to grab their crew to do the horrible tragedy stateside in Texas. So I was in the middle of doing an interview for Australia's Today show, which has nothing to do with our NBC Today show. It's, you know, today in Australia. And I was in Windsor. They had sent a black car for me to London. Limousine picks me up, and it's midnight. You know, it's zero dark 20 or something in London, Windsor. And they take me, and they smack some extra makeup on me. And I'm sitting there in an outdoor gazebo with little space heaters, sitting next to this stunningly gorgeous Grace Kelly-type ice blonde, who's the interviewer for Australian television, and she's interviewing me, and we do the interview, and sort of right after that, I found out the CNN thing that was supposed to happen like an hour later, the black car was supposed to take me back to London, and CNN was going to send a different black car for me to take me, ironically, back to Windsor, but it was CNN's limousine. That got canceled. So I had about 2 hours of sleep, and my husband and I were then going to take the very first train out from Waterloo Station to Windsor, where we had gotten the very last room left in the hotel called the Star and Garter, or Heart and Garter. That was where all the press were going to be, the American press, the CBS unit with Gail King and everything, doing all of their interviews, and also where I had been asked by Facebook. Facebook was doing a whole Facebook Live all day long, and they had commandeered much of the lobby in this Heart and Garter for a great big gala, and they had invited a number of authors who had written about the royal family to broadcast live from Little Room Upstairs. And so we got there at dawn and left our stuff before you could check into the hotel. And I was there with a friend of mine also, and my husband. But my friend and I decided we were going to just kind of do a reconnaissance walk all along the high street of Windsor. And there were buntings everywhere. If you've never been to Windsor, it's a charming little Tudor town. It's on the opposite side of the river from Eton, which is where both Harry and William went to school, and where generations of 19 British prime ministers and a number of royals and a number of famous people like Eddie Redmayne have gone to school. And Harry and William would often take a break and kind of go up the hill and visit Granny for tea at Windsor Castle. It's a lovely little town. It has one major street going through it, and it still has half-timbered houses and pubs.
I know. I love it. And I, as a matter of fact, there are some lovely old bookstores there, and I used to haunt that street. I have many of my favorite books are from Windsor because I lived about 30 miles away from Windsor.
Lucky you.
Oh,
lucky you. It's just so beautiful there. And what my husband and I had done the day before was we went out there earlier, and that's how the day before, that's how we found out we got the last hotel room, because we realized that I needed to be there the day of the wedding anyway. So we stayed our last two nights. We did stay in Windsor instead of London because we knew I needed to be there for the wedding. And we walked around, and all of the shops and the pubs and everything, there were buntings, not just the Union Jack, but the Stars and Stripes. And it was this beautiful marriage of course, not just Harry and Meghan, but the special relationship that the U.S. has with the U.K. And it could bring tears to your eyes. There was just this, and people from all over the world and people starting to mingle, the trains were absolutely mobbed. I mean, it was standing room only at 5 o'clock in the morning and in Waterloo Station and on the trains, and a real holiday mood. They had anticipated something like only 100,000 people would show up in the streets, and I think there were probably 100,000 people on the trains. But it was, people started to fill the streets early in the morning and were wandering. It was a bit chilly. Even though it was May 19th, but Britain in,
oh, yes,
May,
I know.
A little chilly, you know, a little chilly at 5, 6, 7 in the morning. And I had worked on my wardrobe, you know, because I knew I was going to be on camera. And I had a coral-colored short-sleeve dress with kind of interesting origami sleeves. And I, of course, I had a hat. I mean, who doesn't? And I had changed into my high heels when I got to the hotel. And my friend Elizabeth and I were... We decided we were going to walk the length of the high street down to the Long Walk, which is about 2 miles. It's called the Long Walk for your listeners. It's a beautiful, it is a long walk.
It's a road that
winds straight through Windsor Great Park up to the castle. And people had started camping out, and it's bordered on either side by beautiful green lawns. And people had started camping out and putting blankets and that sort of thing down on the long walk, on either side of the long walk, because this is where Meghan and Harry were going to go on their carriage ride after the wedding. There had been a much publicized carriage ride. They would go through town. The open carriage would take them down the long walk so that people could see them. And there were big screens that were set up, too. It was like Jumbotrons, so that you could watch the wedding in Windsor, in the chapel. You could watch the wedding on the Jumbotron from the Great Park on the Long Walk, and then you could actually see them if you were close enough. If you got there early enough, you would see the carriage go by. Or if you were standing anywhere in town on the high street and you were close enough. So people were getting there very, very early and staking their spots. And it had a sort of real-life Renaissance fair feel to it. There were booths that we're setting up as early as 7 in the morning, that we're selling crepes and not quite yet gin and tonics or Pimm's cups, but you knew they were going to, and beer and that kind of thing. Not alcohol that early, but they were setting up for it. And there was such an incredible, excited atmosphere. Some people were dressed actually in costume. There were some women wearing wedding gowns that were carrying signs that said, "Marry me, Harry." There was a woman from one of the Caribbean islands who had made the most beautiful, I'm sure I took a photo of it, she had made herself a spectacular gown and headdress that was made out of a textile that looked like the Union Jack. And people were wearing all sorts of things. Some people were really dressed up. Some people were wearing sort of, you know, cheap, sparkly dime store tiaras. The guy who is the town crier, Tony Appleton, he's in my book. He was who's, you know, there's no such thing as a real town crier nowadays, of course, but he's the self-appointed official town crier, and he wears a badge, a ribbon badge on his doublet, his Tudor-type doublet, that says something like Royal Town Crier. He was walking the streets and ringing his bell, you know, hear ye, oh yay, you know, royal wedding, blah, blah, blah. So I had my friend Elizabeth. I'm like, "Elizabeth, I'm going to walk next to him. Take a picture. So I have a couple of pictures of me in my coral dress and my pale beige hat, and I'm walking next to Tony Appleton. I'm sure he didn't appreciate anyone else being in the picture with him. But it was really, it was great fun.
And we, and over then, here in the States, we were glued to our TVs, to our tellies. We were watching every minute that they covered.
Well, it was interesting because I watched the ceremony itself from the tellies inside the lobby of the hotel where they had it set up for the Facebook Live authors, because where on the high street, you're actually nowhere near the chapel itself. So I thought, well, it makes no sense to try to walk up near the chapel because we're not going to get inside it anyway. And to stand outside, the crowds were getting so thick that, and I'm petite, I'm 5'2", and even in my heels, let's make that a 5'5", but everybody was taller than I am anyway. So I was thinking, okay, do I run outside and try to see the carriage as it comes down the hill, or do I just watch it on the telly? And I thought, this is crazy. I have to, you know, I'll have to write about this for subsequent things or talk about it. It just makes sense to watch this. And I think I set my DVR back home. I live in Denver now to see it, but I thought, I better watch this because it's going to be, I can see it more clearly on the coverage than trying to jump up and down like a little kid in a candy store window, because everybody there is taller than I am and there's a crush and I won't see anything. So I might as well just watch it on the screen. So I did that, and they had the hotel and Facebook had this incredible spread of food out all day and champagne flowing all day. So if you wanted to sit down inside and everybody, they had extra plugs for everyone's computers, and we were basically kind of live streaming it, you know, live tweeting it, but it was live Facebook instead of Twitter, all day long, just kind of giving, you know, catch-ups on everything that was going on, and everyone was glued to the telly. And making comments, "Oh, Megan's dress, oh, it's long sleeves." Well, of course, it was going to be long sleeves because St. George's Chapel at Windsor is what is known, and I wrote this in American Princess, it is what is known as a royal peculiar, which is a peculiar phrase to American ears, but it's in the control of the monarch as opposed to the Church of England, which means it has even more strict religious rules to it. So you have to wear an even more conservative wedding gown than you might wear even if you were married in Westminster Abbey or St. Paul's Cathedral. So, of course, Meghan was going to be covered up. for all of the Americans that speculated that she was going to look like some Santa Monica Beach bride, they really hadn't done their homework. So I didn't expect that she was going. The dress that she wore for her reception, that beautiful halter dress, would not have been the appropriate dress to wear during the ceremony, of course. So everybody teared up, of course, during the ceremony and during the exchange of vows. And the Americans in the crowd were just thrilled with Bishop Curry's sermon. He just stole the day. And laughing like crazy at the expressions on the faces of the royal family, especially Camilla, for instance, who looked like, you know, what am I watching? You know, who is this gent? But, you know, quoting Martin Luther King and the whole love speech, it was just wonderful.
Well,
it was a once-in-a-lifetime experience. It really was.
Well, you covered it so beautifully. And, of course, I just want to remind my listeners that one of the reasons that you were in demand for interviews is that you have written so much about royal marriages, including a book called Notorious Royal Marriages,
yeah.
Royal Romances, Royal Affairs. You know so much about royal weddings.
Royal marriages, royal pains, I can't forget.
Yeah. So I have
from
to take
the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Exactly. I have to take a commercial break. But when I come back, we're going to talk about all of your other books. Okay. So just hold
okay.
on. Okay. We'll be right back.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
Are you an author? An artist? An inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660. Or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
How many of you listening today yearn to write stories, poems, or novels? Each of you has a story to tell, or knows of a story that others would love to read if only you could put the words on a page. The many writers' clubs in the Bay Area understand this urge and would welcome any new writer to learn with them. So go ahead and take the first step to becoming a well-known author. Sponsored by the Pinellas Writers Club.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Patsy with the Z, and I am back with my very special guest. I don't know, she's just so many women all rolled into one. As a nonfiction author, she is known as Leslie Carroll.
The Sibyl of authors.
Wow, and of course, Leslie, you have written so many wonderful books about royal marriages, and so we're going to talk about that. But before we talk about that, I want to mention that you are also Juliet Gray. And your trilogy of Marie Antoinette, her life in three stages of her life, is just a fantastic trilogy and a wonderful book for anyone who wants to know about royalty and wants to know about France. You just take us right there, and I love that trilogy.
Thank you so much. That's story. Marie Antoinette is the gift that keeps giving to me, because it's been translated into several languages, actually, which delights me. But I was so moved to write the Marie Antoinette's real story because she's been one of the handful of royals that's really been propagandized who doesn't deserve it. I mean, to me, there are some that I've written about, like Richard III, that really deserved it. I'm one of those people who's not a Ricardian, who really thinks Richard had motive and opportunity to do all the dastardly deeds he did. But Marie Antoinette was somebody who has truly been otherized and victimized and
maligned through the ages.
Maligned through the ages. I mean, I did at the Historical Novel Society's recent conference a month ago. I did was on a panel about the French Revolution and historical fiction, and I was heartened when I asked a whole audience, yes, granted they were writers, but still, and readers, asked an audience, you know, how many, raise your hand if you think Marie Antoinette really said let them eat cake, and thank God nobody raised their hands, and you all passed. But it makes me crazy even when journalists, Pulitzer Prize winners today who should know better, write an op-ed or something where they say, refer to Marie Antoinette in the Let Them Eat Cake remark when they're talking about a politician or a socialite or anybody who behaves in an entitled or greedy manner, because Marie Antoinette, when we talk about people, even like Meghan or Harry, who was raised to give back to people who have less, Marie Antoinette was the youngest daughter. She was the 15th of 16 children born to Empress Maria Theresa of the Habsburg Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And her mother, no, she wasn't the brightest bulb in the box, but her mother brought her to convents and you know, they distributed alms to the poor every week. This is what they did. It was the French court that did not give to the people and was out of touch. But historically also, French queens were just consorts. They did not co-rule with their husbands. They had zero political power. And it was much to Maria Theresa's consternation, being a sovereign herself and being one of the two most powerful people in the Western world, Catherine the Great being the other one at the time, wondering why her daughter couldn't influence her husband, who was at first Dauphin of France, the crown prince, and then later Louis the 16th. She couldn't figure out why Marie Antoinette couldn't seem to influence him politically. And Marie Antoinette not only had no interest in being a political, and no aptitude for it, in being a political animal, but it just wasn't done in France. Consorts had no say, no power. She was not a Madame de Pompadour, who was a royal mistress and who was vilified for being basically Louis the 15th's prime minister in petticoats. And I just felt that poor Marie Antoinette, and even her husband, who reminded me kind of the fat kid in school who was so maligned because he was clumsy, he was nearsighted, and the royals were not allowed to wear eyeglasses because it looked like a sign of weakness, which is ridiculous because it would have corrected his eyesight. But to have worn spectacles would have been an overt admission to his ministers and to the public that there was some sign of weakness. And of course, the king was God's anointed messenger on earth in France.
In the book, all of this really comes through. And I think the way you've really humanized them, you know, and taken them off of this historical nonsense. That's one of the reasons I love this trilogy.
Thank you. I have always felt, and I was always a history nerd. I'm like, it's funny, my sister and I grew up in the same 9x12 bedroom in the Bronx, or 8x10 bedroom, and I fell in love with history and she didn't. And I've always felt that if teachers were passionate about it, and I had some of the same we went to the same school, and we didn't always have the same teachers. And mine, luckily, I got passionate ones about about history, and she didn't get some of the same teachers. But I always felt that if history teachers could explain that these figures from the past, they are, I always said, the royals are just like us. They just had better clothes and jewelry. But they are human. And they did have flaws, and they did have foibles, and they had real thoughts. They aren't some dusty, one-dimensional person.
And I think knowing history is so, this, to like study the royal family, for example, it, you learn so much history. You start putting things in place and start understanding where things come from, and sort of the genesis of what we're doing today relates to what happened so many years ago. And
absolutely.
And well, this is important.
If you don't study the past, you're doomed to repeat its mistakes. And it is a truism. It's not a cliche. And when I was writing the third book in the trilogy, which takes place during the French Revolution, it begins in October 1789 with the disgruntled fishwives march on Versailles, and it ends in October 1793 with the execution of Marie Antoinette, which should not come as a surprise to your readers because everybody who existed in the 18th century is dead by now, okay? So get out the Kleenex. But I was writing it at a time, the book was published in 2013, so I was writing it around 2012, I guess. And it was a rise of right-wing politics in America where, and the otherization of President Obama, and I was not thinking of American politics when I was writing the book. I was thinking about French politics when I was writing the book. I didn't need to think about anybody else's politics but the French Revolution when I was writing the book, and I was deeply steeped in it. But the parallels between revolutions and the voices of revolutionaries and when the French Revolution, they ate their own. It started out with a faction that wanted the people to be represented, which is something you see everywhere, but then it became more and more and more conservative, and the more conservative voices began to eat the less conservative voices until it became mob rule and blood running in the streets and classicide, so that everybody, even if Patsy, you had worked as a chambermaid at the home of somebody who had a royal, an aristocratic-sounding name, you know, the de in the title, you know, Leslie de Carroll, you would be guillotined just because you worked in their home and you took their money. I mean, it was everything was taken to the most absurd degree. Children were butchered. If you read the history of what happened in the September massacres in 1792, orphans were killed in the streets, and priests were just, their heads were lopped off, their entrails were ripped out, and I know I'm getting gory here, but it's just, the violence is unthinkable. The French Revolution did not, in fact, emulate the American Revolution
No. In
any way. I mean, even though there were French nobles that came over here, like Lafayette, who fought on the side, and the American Revolution could not have been won had it not been for money from the French crown, and the reason they gave us money was because their biggest enemy was Great Britain. So if they could weaken Great Britain by helping Britain's greatest enemy, which was the U.S., then great, you know. The best thing they could do was to weaken their enemy, which was Britain. How can we do that? We can help the U.S. But the French came back with these ideals of liberty and equality, but that didn't mean
that they put it into practice.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it wasn't an army versus an army, which in the American Revolution, it was the British army fighting, as ragtag as it was, George Washington's Revolutionary Army. This was a bunch of self-described in France, that wasn't an army. That was a bunch of people who were vigilantes who were hanging people from lampposts and deciding they were going to, you know, put a guillotine in the squares of the plazas of Paris and cutting off the heads of anybody who had blue blood. Well, guess what? Everybody's blood is red. It was a horrifying way to go about things.
And
it didn't...
This, you know, in your book, you bring this horrible death to life because we really, you're very, you know, compelling author, and you know how to tell a story. You know, and that's what I love about your books. I love royalty, any books about royalty myself, because it fills in the history of a country. You know, you start to understand them. As I said, I lived in England. I lived in a little village not far from Windsor, and I actually had a priest hole in my cottage. I bought a cottage when I was 21, a 400-year-old cottage, and I had a priest hole.
Oh, wow, wonderful.
In the basement.
Wow.
Because that's it was where near Reading Cathedral, and the priests, mm-hmm. you know, were escaping during Henry VIII's time, and so
sure.
it's so fascinating, and that's why I just so enjoy history. I lived in England, then I traveled.
And those religious wars in England went on for hundreds and hundreds of years between the Catholics and the Protestants, and of course during the Tudor era you had, you know, Henry was replaced by his son Edward VI, who was a rampant Protestant to the extent of, you know, really detesting Catholics, but he was replaced by Mary, who was a rampant Catholic who detested Protestants, and she was replaced by Elizabeth I, who, you know, was then putting Catholics to death, and this did not stop. And then of course you have Charles II, who, you know, I'm always fascinated by because of his many mistresses and his terrible marriage, but because he had no legitimate child, his brother, who was a Catholic, replaced him, and then he fled the throne in the Glorious Revolution and was replaced by William and Mary, and then we finally get a constitutional monarchy.
Because it's time to
stop the Catholic versus Protestant stuff. But again, you had all of these.
But it was still lingering up until, you know, as you said.
It was still lingering. And you have the law in 1701, you have a law that prohibits a Catholic from acceding to the throne, or anyone who marries a Catholic is barred. And until just a couple of years ago, this statute was still on the books. And there were... I'm trying to remember which royal it was. I think it was Anne, Princess Anne, who married Autumn Kelly. Autumn Kelly she was a Canadian, and she was a Catholic. She married, was it Anne's son or something? He had to give, I believe, some reader will call in. Yeah, a listener will call in. He had to give up his right to the throne, even though he was way, way down, because he married a Catholic back in 2008.
Well, in all of your research, and did you ever figure out what it was about Anne Boleyn? Because really, so much of this happened, and if you look at it, Anne Boleyn played a major part in America that she never heard about, because we would not be the same country if Henry VIII had not divorced his Catholic wife, had not become the Church of England. Think of how much different we would be today, or if we'd even be there, because the Catholic attitude was so much different from the you know, Church of England attitude, where the those people then started thinking more about freedom and rights. And have you?
I hadn't thought about it that way. Now you've given me food for thought for the next 6 weeks or so.
I want to know what was it about her? Because everything changed because of her.
Well, I've always thought of Anne Boleyn as the greatest influence on the Christian religion since Jesus Christ, which is a very big bombshell to drop, because everybody was Catholic. Well, the Lutherans, you had Germany, of course, but in general, England was a superpower at the time. And England, because Henry VIII couldn't get into Anne Boleyn's knickers without a ring, Anne Boleyn was a tremendous influence on him to break with the Church of Rome and to become the head of his own church. And she said to him, why do you need to answer to the Pope? Why can't the king be the head of his own church and the head of his own religion in England? And without Anne Boleyn's influence, and granted he had ministers who had the same belief, but he didn't want to get into those ministers' knickers and have a son by them. It was Anne Boleyn, primarily.
So what
and even though...
What was it about her?
Well, men want what they can't have, right? So, I mean, she held out. And she was smart. She was seductive. Beauty, of course, is a subjective thing. I mean, there was something about her. She knew how to play him like a violin. And Henry loved the thrill of the chase. She understood what it was he wanted. He wanted to chase something. He didn't want to win it. She saw what happened when, if he could get what he wanted, he was done. He got her sister, and he treated her like garbage once they had an affair. He didn't even give her a decent settlement, Mary Boleyn.
Yeah, and then this one comes along, and you're right. She changed
the course of history.
Absolutely.
How many women can you name who have changed the course of European history in such a profound way? Now, one can argue for better or for ill, but think about the profound influence Anne Boleyn had. And had it not been for Anne Boleyn, there would not have been an Elizabeth I, who was arguably the greatest monarch England ever had, better than her father.
Oh, absolutely.
And better than Queen Victoria, I think. I mean, Victoria, again, was a constitutional monarch. Elizabeth was an autocrat because there was no... I mean, there was a parliament, but...
She did it all.
But she really, yeah. And she was... Elizabeth was educated in the way the Tudor princes were. She was still educated the way that men were in that day, meaning that she was a polymath. This woman spoke multiple languages, and she knew her science and her astronomy and her geography, and this woman was spectacularly well-rounded and well-educated. You know, Elizabeth was a Renaissance
and a real showwoman. She knew how to make a statement. And I was recently reading about, you know, she had like 4,000 dresses, and she always,
yes.
Tell me.
There was an exhibit I went to. I took a class, an art history four section course here in Denver, because there's an exhibit, some zillionaire bequeathed his collection of Tudor-era paintings to the Denver Art Museum, and so they had an art history series of lectures on the Tudor era, and there was one on women in Tudor painting, and so they did a whole thing on Elizabeth and the dresses and the meaning of the dresses and the one with all the eyes on it and how... This was her. Obviously, we know that clothing tells its own story, and especially with royals who can't speak for themselves. And we can talk about the royal women who are not supposed to say anything politically, like, you know, Meghan or Catherine, or, you know, who are not supposed to have a political opinion, but their clothing speaks volumes. Or Diana, for instance.
Oh, you know, this is heartbreaking, because I could go on for another hour with you, and we still
I know.
We still haven't gotten to all of the other royal weddings and royal affairs. There's so much.
I will come back. I promise you.
Okay, absolutely.
As we're leading into, we're talking about tutors, and I understand you have my incredible friend, Margaret George. I'm giving her a segue, a pitch. Margaret is one of my dearest friends and colleagues.
And she's going to be on
more
August 13th. And I'm giving her the whole hour. I don't usually give people a whole hour, but for you
well,
two.
On August 13th, I will be at Versailles doing more research for another project on French royalty. So.
Well, your ears will be ringing because we will be talking about you too. So I just want to, before you have to go and before I have to stop this, I want to tell everyone that your website is lesliecarroll.com, and they can see...
Yes, Carroll with two R's and two L's, like Lewis Carroll.
Exactly. And it's a great website. They can see all of your books there, lovely book covers. You have fantastic book covers. And they can read, you know, get your books, read more about you, and as you said, you're going to be back because there were so many less famous people that I want to talk about, but who had fantastic and interesting affairs or weddings. So you'll be back, okay?
I will be back, I promise.
Okay.
It's always so much fun to talk to you.
Well, Leslie Gray. I'm Leslie Gray. Leslie Carroll.
Julia Gray. Who am I this time?
Isn't there
a book, Who Am I This Time, or something, or it's a movie?
Yeah. Oh, and we didn't even get to talk about Mismatch, which I love.
All my contemporary stuff. I said to you, that was a walk down memory lane, all those contemporary books, which make me homesick for my hometown, New York City.
Oh, and you're so funny. That book cracks me up. We have to talk about that next time. So you'll be back soon.
That's one of the stories of my life. My New York City books tend to be Romana Clef.
Yes.
Especially Temporary Insanity. That was the story of me being a temp in legal offices and
you're going to be back.
Stuff that's 95% true.
Well, I have to say bye-bye, but have a wonderful, wonderful trip to Europe, and you'll be back, okay?
I'll be thinking of you, and I will be back. Yes.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Thank you always.
Bye,
and
Leslie.
Thank you to all your incredible listeners and readers.
Okay. Thank you so much, Leslie. Bye now.
Sure. Okay. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. Whoa, this is fantastic. The hour went so fast. Remember, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them in an audible book. Or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, a streaming video, or perhaps even on the Hallmark Channel, like I hope that... Carol J. Perry's book will be, and I want to say that next week, Sherry Harris is going to be on Let's Fake a Deal. I just got her new book, Let's Fake a Deal, a garage sale mystery. I love garage sale mysteries. I'm always going to garage sales, and I'm always looking for an odd dead body, and then I will be able to talk to Sherry Harris about it. But she's going to be on soon, and just, it's been a wonderful day, and I was thank Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Ed. He's saluting me. I'm saluting him. We have to get going. Bye-bye now.